Thanks so much for joining us today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here as we broadcast from the Food and Farm Exploration Center in Plover, Wisconsin. Great to have a live audience with us today. And you know, the last Monday of the month, we always have what we call the Weather Guys Show. And Steve Ackerman and John Martin, our weather guys, are normally with us. But here we thought we would take an opportunity to get another weather guy involved in the operation, because we're in Plover, Wisconsin today. And so we were able to latch on to Tony Schumacher. Tony is, lots of people know Tony around here. He's the owner and chief meteorologist of the Great Lakes Weather Service. His 31-year career included working as a meteorologist for WAOW-TV in Wausau from 1999 to 2023. And now, of course, he is the chief meteorologist, owner of the Great Lakes Weather Service. And it's great to have him with us. We can talk pretty much, I'm pretty sure. Welcome, by the way. Thank you so much, Tony, for joining us.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
I know we can talk weather and climate in general, but I also wanted to zero in a little bit on this part of the state. Before we get going on that, I want to talk a little bit about the Great Lakes Weather Service, mm-hmm. because, you know, I went online to take a look at it. I thought, okay, this I wonder if this is a one-person operation. And then I see you got, what, five or six
That's right.
meteorologists.
Right. We've actually been expanding in this past year. This is a company that started about 50 years ago in Wisconsin by a different gentleman. And I worked for him right out of college part-time and for a couple of years, and I really enjoyed it. But I was also in the TV business, and one thing led to another, and I got a job opportunity. Hopped from Channel 7 in Wausau to a Green Bay station.
Yeah.
And so I had to say goodbye to Great Lakes Weather for a couple of years. But I had told the owner that I said, if you ever want to sell it, let me know. I'd be interested in getting into that. And sure enough, a couple of years later, he wrote me a letter and saying that he needed to retire because of health reasons. Mm-hmm. And I was able to work out a deal with WAOW-TV in Wausau, who mm-hmm. wanted me to come back and work in Wausau as well. To help me purchase that company, and I've been running it ever since, about 25 years.
So. Yeah, it's amazing, give my hand on that. I think what people may not realize that it's not just related to the TV programs. That certainly is, but right. But there's a whole lot more involved here.
Absolutely, we provide forecasts to agriculture, which is so important to this part of Wisconsin and all through the Midwest. We have utility companies as customers, school districts, road construction, paving operations. We have marine interests like ferries that cross the Great Lakes, ski hills, plowing operations for city street departments for their winter ice and snow removal, outdoor events like large public theaters outside. It just goes on and on and on. There's always the very acute need for critical weather information.
So. I guess what interested me, what I thought was really cool, is you, the company, provides very specific information to these individual clients.
Right. That's the whole thing with it, is that we're able to deal with them on an individual level, dial in and produce a forecast down as close as we possibly can for their area. And that's a big difference between my TV career and this career. TV is broadcast as much of radio. You know, we're covering, for example, the Wausau market was like 17 counties, basically all the way from the upper Michigan border down to Wisconsin Dells almost. And so as you can imagine, on many days, the weather is wildly different from county to county, even within a county. But yet you're living in the confines of time and TV, where you have to produce a weather broadcast that's maybe 30 seconds long or sometimes 3 minutes long, and try to break down what's happening in all these places, not only for the next couple of hours, but for the next 7 days. And that's really a struggle that I kind of felt my whole career in TV, is that I always had more inside me than I could actually get out, because the time just, you know, cuts you off. And so that's what I like about my own business, is that we're able to really spend more time and be more detailed with each customer.
And all your staff, they're all trained meteorologists and...
That's correct. And they all have, you know, specialties. Some really enjoy certain types of severe weather. Some like winter weather. Some enjoy lake effect snow. Some are, you know, and which is good. We want a variety of different strengths putting together a team like that.
You said you learned a lot about lake effect, how the lake affects weather. I saw somewhere you said when you were in Green Bay, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I worked in Green Bay for 2 years and got to watch some crazy storms coming off the Bay of Green Bay and Lake Michigan, and had viewers real localized spots along the shore of Lake Michigan that would get dumped with a surprise 8 inches of lake effect snow, and just different things like that that we'd watch very carefully. And we had our crazy winter there when I was there, the winter of 1997 and 98. I'm not sure if you remember that. That was a super warm winter. We had a super El Nino, just like we had this past winter. And we were setting record high after record high. It was still about 60 degrees going up to Christmas. People were out golfing, grass was green. And I actually had a chance to be on CNN because they caught on that the weather was so crazy up in the frozen tundra. Because, you know, the Packers had just won the Super Bowl in 1997, so we were kind of popular yet at that time. So anyway, they got a hold of my TV station, WFRV, and they had me do a live shot with one of their anchors, their news anchors, during their noon show, and to talk about the warm weather. But the thing I'll never forget about that is he could not get our call letters right. He was trying to introduce me, and he kept saying, well, now from WFRI, WVFR, WF, and then he finally gave up and jumped to my name. So I was thinking, oh, no, my one shot at national fame, and it got messed up.
And then here I was today introducing you at rushing and saying Dick Pavelski. Tony Schumacher.
It's okay.
I don't know what it is about your name, Tony. You know, the technology today, I mean, what are you, I mean, you're working on the latest and greatest stuff.
Well, that's really awesome. You know, when I look back to when I started my career in 1993 to now, it's just like night and day difference. My first TV job in Wausau at Channel 7, we were allowed to download 4 satellite images a day. That's it, every 6 hours. And then when I did my 10 o'clock news, I was able to loop those 4 images together and make a crude loop of what was going on. But boy, all the information in between that was happening that I couldn't show or track. We were still using the radar from NINA, the old radar system, which was very crude. It was not a Doppler radar, and we were a long ways from the radar site. So we were very limited. Computer models were crude yet. They did not come out very often. And we had to use the old DIFAX printers. I don't know if any of you know what a DIFAX printer is, but it's kind of an analog thing that when the information came in, it would go, chirt, 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 chirt. And so, you know, we knew a weather model should be coming in at 6 a.m., but it would probably take about 6 hours to print. And so by the time we saw it, you know, it was well out of date. But nowadays, everything is instantaneous. We're getting high-resolution images, you know, down to a half a mile or less every few minutes, anywhere in the world, via the internet and other means. Radar technology has been advancing steadily as well, and that's just the tip of the iceberg. So just trying to sort through all this great data we have nowadays is really tremendous.
Tony Schumacher, our guest today, owner and chief meteorologist at the Great Lakes Weather Service. Of course, he's had a long and distinguished career at WAOW-TV as well. Questions for him? Give a call. The number is 800-642-1234. You got a weather question? We'd love to hear it. Or maybe you've got something about a question about Tony's own experiences in the weather forecasting business. 800-642-1234. You could also email us to talk@wpr.org. Or somebody in the live audience here today, if you have a question or a comment, for Tony, just go ahead and raise your hand, and we will, Jill Nadoa, our executive producer, is big smile on her face right now. She travels over to find a person who wants to ask a question, and we'll get that in just a minute. You know, what is it about, I just want to ask, whether meteorologists on TV are often the the most liked. They are often the most liked people, and they're often asked to do kind of weird things from time to time.
Great.
I was thinking of a guy, you may have remembered this name, Elmer Childress, mm-hmm. was a weather forecaster, and he worked in Madison for many years. And he would be involved, and he might sing a song. He would just do anything anybody asked him. And you probably get a little of that, too.
Well, you know, I think it goes back partly to the old day of TV news way back when it started. The weather person often was kind of an entertainer. They weren't necessarily a scientist.
Yeah.
You know, like the Willard Scott types. And I worked with a gentleman named, a very beloved name, Howard Gernetzky. I'm sure some of you know Howard. I loved Howard. In fact, when I first worked at Channel 7, I had to prepare his weather broadcast for him, his maps and everything. And I learned a lot from him about just being a performer, because when you're up in front of the camera or in front of the microphone, you are a performer, whether you like it or not.
Yeah.
And hopefully you can get the information in without compromising it. But people want to have a pleasant experience when they're watching or listening. And so that's probably part of it, you know, and part of it is with people liking the weather person is that weather affects everybody, right? Unless you stay inside your entire life and do nothing outside, mm-hmm. you know, weather, even if you stay inside, weather affects you. It affects how you heat your house or your building. It affects brightness and, you know, all sorts of things. So it's kind of a common denominator that everybody can talk about to one level or another, and I think that draws people to weather people. But on the other hand, I will say we do get the ire of people as well. It's not all good. I mean, I have had death threats over the years. You know, people call up and say we ruined their picnic or their big activity because we said it was going to be sunny and a shower popped up or whatever. And you know, you hope that never happens, but it is, some people do take it overboard. And I've had people tell me they were pointing a gun at me and, you know, things like that. So it's not all great.
Yeah. Well, I think for the most part, though, you're pretty, you and your compatriots are pretty well liked.
I think so. Yeah, overall, very much so.
We have a question from the audience, I believe. Let's take that.
Hi, thanks for being here. My question has to do with weather terminology. Mm-hmm. A few years back, my husband and I were traveling through Kentucky and had to stay in a hotel and made some chit-chat with a local person, and I happened to mention a weather event that they were going to be having, a bomb cyclone.
Oh.
And he very quickly told me that was fake news, there was no such thing, and now they're just making up terms. So terms that we hear now, like bomb cyclone, polar vortex, derecho, I don't remember hearing those like 20 years ago. So has that always been the terminology, and why are we now hearing it?
Well, yeah, certainly. Those are things that have been around for 50, 100 years or more, those terms, but they were kind of reserved to the academic community, maybe a college. It goes back to the last question. You know, in the old days, the weather people were more entertainers or just friendly people delivering a forecast that they pulled off from the National Weather Service and basically just presented. But as the broadcasters themselves became scientists, it became part of our job, essentially, to be educators besides just presenters. So I think that's probably where it comes from. And now in the day of internet, everybody can look up those things on their own. And so then they're super curious about it because they read about it. They see somebody posting on Facebook about it. And so then you're kind of forced in a way to talk about things that maybe you wouldn't have, but now that kind of the cat's out of the box or whatever, you know. But I think it's a good thing. It's all good to educate the public. And, you know, some people might think it sounds scary to say polar vortex, but it's an actual physical thing. And so we just got to talk about it.
Yeah, there you go. Tony Schumacher, our guest today, chief meteorologist of the Great Lakes Weather Service, our guest. You can join in, too. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or email to talk@WPR.org, or we'll take a question from the audience. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Taking a look at weather and climate right now and zeroing in on, well, I would say the Central Sands area of Wisconsin, just a little bit with our guest, Tony Schumacher, owner and chief meteorologist of the Great Lakes Weather Service. He spent many years at WAOW-TV in Wausau. We're here to answer your questions, and we have a question from the audience, so let's go there.
Thank you. Being an avid cross-country skier, I'm wondering if we'll have a normal winter of snows this winter. And second question is, how often do you reference the Farmer's Almanac?
As far as the snow goes, there's a pretty good chance we'll have a decent winter, at least an average winter. It certainly should be much better than last year for cross-country skiing based on what we're seeing with the La Nina ocean pattern developing that typically usually brings us above normal precipitation in Wisconsin during the winter. Now, temperatures can fluctuate up or down during La Nina, so that can be an issue, but overall it trends around average or maybe a little cooler. So hopefully you can get those skis out many, many times this year.
I was wondering specifically about January 11th. Can you
really
tell me?
Wow. That's going to be maybe if you call me in a week, I'll be able to.
Go ahead. I'm
sorry. Yeah, and as far as the second part of the question, the Farmer's Almanac, it's fun to look at. I think every year on TV I talked about it, or when I was doing my radio broadcasts, just to say what they were saying, but I really never put much stock in it, and I didn't really know any meteorologist that did.
John Martin, who is one of our weather guys, hates discussions about
right.
about it.
No, it's fun to look at, but honestly, there's really no credible scientific reasoning to it. So if they happen to get lucky once in a while, so be it, but it's nothing we can hang our hat on.
Let's take another question from the audience, and then we'll go to the phones.
Hi, thanks for taking my question. We've been lucky to see the Northern Lights a few times this season, and I'm wondering, is there a correlation between the Northern Lights and our weather?
Well, you know, that's kind of an interesting question. There's certainly research ongoing in regards to that, but you know, nothing real solid as far as weather down that we experience here. It's more in the upper atmosphere. As you get into the layers, that's bordering space where things can change a little bit. But I'm sure in upcoming years, as we get more technology up in space, we'll get a little bit better handle on that. But it probably does. You know, everything is related in our Earth atmosphere universe in one way or another. So it would not surprise me.
Andy in Door County will take a question from you. Thanks for calling.
Hi, good afternoon, Larry and Tony. Thanks for taking my question. My question was, it was, I think, August 23rd of 1998, we had a water spout that came across the bay of Green Bay from that spawned from the supercell and then turned into a tornado that went through the Egg Harbor, Carlsville area in Door County. And I just wanted to kind of get your thoughts on that. Is that kind of a rare event that occurs, or is that more common than we think? And just wanted to get your thoughts on it. Thank you for taking my time.
Thank you.
Yeah. Well, you know, that is sort of rare. Tornadoes don't happen all too often over the Great Lakes. It's more of the water spout, the real transient features that are a little bit different than supercell thunderstorms. So to have kind of a hybrid like that was unusual. I do remember that system vaguely. So that's really the main one that sticks out in my mind of working in Wisconsin for many years, that was kind of that hybrid case. Usually the water spouts, you know, just pop up without a major thunderstorm around. So we'll see what happens, but that's always something to watch for if you're a mariner, for sure.
I got to believe the Doppler radar made a huge impact for you as somebody trying to follow or predict or follow the path of tornadoes.
Yeah, tornadoes and high winds both, because now we are able to actually get an estimate of how strong the winds might be and where in relation to spots on the earth that wind is changing in direction. So my first experience was with the Big Flats tornado of August of 1994. We had just had the new National Weather Service radars installed, at least they were starting to get installed. We had one in Sullivan, which is between Madison and Milwaukee. And with that radar, we were able to actually get a pretty good bead on the Big Flats tornado coming into Adams County. We could actually see the circulation of that EF3 tornado, which inevitably did take the lives of two people and injured quite a few others. But still, we had a good lead time on it. The warnings came out to help hopefully save a lot of lives. And of course, over the years, we've had many examples now of tracking them. And there's even more tools with the Doppler which have came online in recent years, including the dual pole Doppler radar, which gives us even more information about the air circulation and winds and so on inside tornadoes. And we can now pick up things like debris signatures. So if a tornado is picking up a bunch of debris, there's a special signature that shows up on that dual pole radar, things like that. So it's really great. I hope that continues.
And I know we have another question from the audience, but before we get to that, let's go to Joan in Scandinavia. Joan, hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry and Tony. I have a reason. One of the main reasons I watch the news every evening is for the weather. And I'm 80 years old, so I go way back watching the weather from Bill Carlson. He was a weatherman on WTMJ. He had paper charts like a teacher or professor would have and like a magic marker. So it was pretty crude then. But now I've been noticing the weathermen are so rushed. I watch all the weather shows on different channels, from Green Bay and Wausau. And it just seems like they aren't given enough time. And then they have to talk so fast just to get everything in that they want to say. And so I don't understand why sports are given more time than weather, because the weather...
All right, Joan, thanks for that. Thanks for that question. Tony, well, you probably don't know why the heck sports gets more.
Well, I happen to like sports, so I don't mind that too much. But, you know, there's a whole lot of people that work together to put a newscast on. There's producers, there's directors, there's news directors, there's the advertising team that wants to see their ads get on the show. You know, it all has to pay for itself. We have to pay for all the fancy equipment that we use. We have to pay for the vehicles that drive around and get reports. So there's a lot that goes into it. I agree, though, it would be nice to have a little more time for weather. That's my field. But the good thing is when there's really severe weather, the producers are really generous. And they'll say, hey, take another minute, whatever you need to cover the situation. So in those critical times, you can do that. And then all the plus thing, too, is with the internet and the websites and your apps, the information you maybe didn't see on TV, you can catch on your phone through our station or through whoever you're watching. Or through the internet. So yeah, there's other places to get it now.
Yeah. A question from the audience.
I'm curious about your technologies being used for the smoke forecasts, if there even is such a thing, because it seems like that's a fairly, not a new phenomenon, but you're catching up to it. Because I can hear, two days from now it's gonna rain. We don't hear anything about 3 days from now there's going to be smoke in the air, and when we do, it's usually relayed, it's talked about as haze. Is haze and smoke different?
Well, they can be related, but they can be different as well. You know, haze can be caused by multiple different things, not necessarily just smoke. It often is very hazy when it's smoky out, of course, but yeah, you know, technology is getting better. Satellites are getting more in tune with the type of chemicals to look for in terms of tracking it from space. There's more and more instruments being deployed in the ground that can measure smoke particles and the concentrations thereof, and networks being developed where that can be displayed. So the National Weather Service, like the DNR, is getting heavily involved in this. There's kind of a cooperation, and we're definitely getting more lead time. And we even have weather models now that have that parameter in there that can help us see where they expect the smoke to move based on where it's located height-wise and how the winds are behaving. So I think you'll be hearing more and more about this in future years, for sure.
And just as an aside on that, with climate change and, you know, the fires in Canada were probably a result of not as much moisture and higher temperatures than have been exhibited in the past.
Yes, they had a prolonged, last summer in particular, they had a really long drought across much of Canada, and that coupled with high temperatures, and then, of course, fires get started a variety of ways, lightning, human activities, some are arson, of course, and all that just played a horrible trick on everybody last summer. So, and you know, with the climate changing, it's been long predicted by the models that we are going to have more extreme precipitation cycles, whether it be extreme heavy precipitation for periods, could be weeks on months in certain areas, followed by droughts in other parts that'll be more intense. And so this is going to be a major concern for us all in future years.
Let's take another question from the audience.
An earlier questioner was asking about the winter coming up, and is it going to be a harsh winter or strong? Are there any animals or farm animals, or do their coats change or something like that? Or is there anything to that where animals are predictors of what kind of winter's coming up?
Well, you know, of course, I've read a lot of those over the years, and people have told me, you know, that the woolly caterpillar, how wide the stripe is, or how thick the breastbone is on a goose, and many different things like that. The squirrels are gathering lots of acorns and this and that. I haven't found one that's foolproof, have you? I mean,
no.
It's fun to talk about. I mean, in way back, you go hundreds of years before we could forecast the weather with equipment, they had to come up with some way to try to organize life, and so they look to the animals, basically. But I have noticed that the geese do tend to migrate a little quicker when we get some of those sharp cold blasts in November with the strong north winds for a couple of days. But, you know, that's just time of the year that they go anyway, so it's hard to say.
And the wind is playing a role. If they got to follow, exactly. If they got a wind that they can jump
favorable.
On. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Another question from the audience.
How do weathermen know what the weather is going to be like?
A young participant here.
Yes.
Thank you.
Well, you know, it's a very complicated thing. We have to, it's like putting a recipe together. If you're baking a batch of cookies, you take some flour, you take some eggs and, you know, water and milk and vanilla and all that good stuff and chocolate chips, and you have to measure it out in just the right proportion. We have to look at all the information and then put it together. So we're looking at satellite information to help us see where the storm systems are in the clouds. We look at radar to see where precipitation is. We look at weather maps that plot current weather conditions around the Midwest and around the whole world, for that matter, to see where fronts are, like cold fronts and warm fronts and low pressure and high pressure, how they're all moving. And then we use our training and weather models to help us look into the future. So we put that all together, and we use our experience from similar situations in the past to say, hey, when that front was sitting over here this time of the year, this is what happened. Could this happen again? So that all has to work together, and we look at storm reports that are coming in live, and it's kind of a complicated thing, Larry.
It is indeed, and there's a fair amount of training that goes into that.
Absolutely.
You know, talk about your own training. You were at UW. And
yes.
As a matter of fact, probably took courses from our weather guys.
I did. They were very young professors at that time, and I went to the University of Wisconsin in Madison, studied there for 4 years. But even before that, I knew I loved the weather already as a young child. Probably by the time I was 6, I knew I wanted to do something with weather. So I read every book I could get my hands on with the weather, magazines. That was in the days before internet, back in the 1970s and 80s. But I found, even in 4-H, I took a weather project and made a, I think it was like a barometer or something like that. So, but yeah, you can learn a lot on your own, but then you really do need the expertise of those who have studied it many years if you want to become a career meteorologist.
A little bit of math and physics and so forth goes into it as
Correct.
Well.
Correct. And then, if you know, to be an active forecaster, just plain old experience doing it time and time and time again, getting fooled a bunch of times and then remembering your mistake and... You know, and then learning how to communicate it too is a big part of it, Larry, because it's one thing to know what you're looking at, but then how do you explain that to the rest of the people?
Right. Absolutely. Well, let's take another question from the audience.
Before, when you were talking about meteorologists either being really well liked or not so much, I just have a little story is that when you first came on the air, my mom was probably in her late 70s, she was enamored with you. So Christmas was coming up, but not in a weird way, just in a cute way. So Christmas was coming up, and somehow we got a glossy picture of you from the station, and you signed it with her name, and you wrote her a little thing. Mm-hmm. And to the day she died, she had that in a frame, right, sitting on the fireplace mantle.
Well, thank you.
That is great. That's great. Well,
yeah, I've had several stories like that over the years, believe it or not, and I'm just thankful it worked out so well. You know, sometimes it felt like it was going to be a disaster, but we always got through it somehow. So,
thanks so much for that. Let's take another call. Bill in Menominee, we'll go to you. Hi, Bill.
Hi.
My
question was. With the fires in Canada and California, that's generally where we hear about the smoke generating, originating from, Is there a meteorological explanation why the concentration in northern Wisconsin is so heavy?
Of the smoke?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, you know, part of it is that we just lie in what's called the mid-latitudes. It's kind of an area of the world between about 35 and 50 degrees latitude where most of the weather systems track through at one time or another. The jet stream winds are usually pretty strong in that area. Those are winds up, you know, 15 to 30,000 feet. And so once that smoke, that wherever it's being generated, gets up into those winds, it's going to circulate the world basically on the strongest core of winds. And they happen to come through Wisconsin more often than not. So that's the big part of it. Once they get lofted up there 20, 30,000 feet. And then as we have fronts coming through, even with rain and snow and so on, that can help drag some of that smoke aloft down toward the ground. So we've got a lot of things going on here that kind of make it a perfect storm. And then if we have a slow moving pattern where it happens to be here, like last summer, and nothing to move it loose, we happen to have a lot of high pressure nearby. It just sat over us forever. It was horrible. Yeah.
Have you seen the latest movie, Tornado?
Oh, Twister.
Twister, sorry.
You know, I have not. I have not had time. Like I said, my company right now has been growing the past 6 months, so very busy, but I certainly want to see it, and I've heard it's pretty good. Have you seen it?
I haven't. I thought, oh, I'm going to just ask you that just to see what your... what your response might be if you had seen it, how accurate it looked. I've heard some, actually, a lot of pretty positive things about Twister.
Yeah, they generally try to consult with scientists to try to get it as reasonable as possible. So,
Natalie in Menominee, Michigan has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Natalie.
Hi. I'm wondering if your expert knows anything about, well, just one thing in particular about Project 2025. And one of them is if a certain candidate gets elected in November, his administration will eliminate NOAA. And the question is, what things will we as the people be missing without it?
Yes, I have heard that. And then I do believe that's in there. One of the proposals in that document, whoever produced it, is that they would like to get rid of NOAA. I don't know if it's a cost-saving measure or I think part of it is this is an explanation I've read, is that that particular side believes that NOAA is largely responsible for producing research on climate change, and that climate change upsets them. They'd rather just ignore it and pretend it doesn't exist. Well, anyway, I think it would be a horrible thing to get rid of NOAA. They're kind of the backbone of the weather information pipeline of our country and really of the world to a large degree. They fund a lot of the satellites that we use, of course, the really important Doppler radar that we use. It would basically be back to 1800 for all of us in terms of weather in a lot of ways. It really would. The only way you would get your weather is to have somebody maybe freely supply the information on the internet, but probably not, because they're going to have to spend their time and expertise to produce it. So right now we're all helping to fund the National Weather Service and NOAA through our tax dollars because it all benefits us all. Can you imagine how commerce would come to a standstill if we didn't have relatively accurate predictions on a broad scale of weather coming in, how coastal cities might get clobbered by a hurricane that they didn't know was coming? It could be catastrophic. For those of you at home, you know, watching, you like to get your weather off of TV. Well, there's a fair number of TV meteorologists that rely on all the warnings from the National Weather Service and NOAA to rebroadcast to you tornado warnings, severe thunderstorm warnings, flood warnings, blizzard warnings, you name it. So I hope that doesn't happen, honestly. Yes.
Let's go to Dean in who's west of Denver, Colorado, on the air. Dean, hi.
Hi, and thanks for putting on this show. It's been really entertaining and interesting. We sailed the Apostle Islands last year, and that was a revisit from almost 40 years prior. And I was amazed how much warmer that area has gotten in that time, water temperature. And I was wondering if that's led to any visible or substantial changes in thunderstorm activity, since there's a lot more, I would think, moisture, warm moist air available.
Yeah, that's a good question. I know a couple of things that I've read with research-wise. One is that the warmer Great Lakes have caused it to become windier. near the Great Lakes. There's just more mixing of the atmosphere overhead because that warmer air can rise higher and tap into stronger winds and bring them down. So that may play a role in thunderstorms. I think when we're getting talking about the warmer Great Lakes too, we really notice the volatility more in the late fall and winter. Because the water's warmer going into the winter than it used to be, the early parts of winters are often much warmer than they used to be around here in the upper Midwest, close to the Great Lakes. We often get rain closer to the coast, much longer into the winter than they used to. And also the lake effect snow can become more intense if the water temperature is warmer, because then there's a greater difference between the water temperature and the cold air coming in from Canada. So those are a couple of things. As far as the thunderstorm intensity, I haven't read anything particularly about that, but that would not surprise me. You know, it's common for thunderstorms to weaken in the summer as they head toward the waters of the Great Lakes, just because it's cooler than the land typically. But at night, if that water ends up being warmer, much warmer than the air over the land, it could be stronger at night. So that'll definitely bear watching. Thanks for the question.
Yeah, it was a great question. Tony Schumacher, our guest today, chief meteorologist and owner of Great Lakes Weather Service. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. We are broadcasting from Plover, Wisconsin. It's great to have a chance to visit with guests from this area and also to have a live audience. So it's wonderful as we talk weather right now and climate with Tony Schumacher of the Great Lakes Weather Service. And you can join in 800-642-1234. You could email us to talk at WPR.org. Or we'll take a question from our live audience, and we have one right now, so let's go there.
Thank you. Tony, as you were answering your last question especially, it's just amazing the depth of like the science and just the really deep knowledge that you have. And you had said a while back that you always knew you wanted to be in weather.
Yes.
What? And here it's your career. I mean, you're super involved. What was it that...
Well, you know, I grew up on a dairy farm here right in north central Wisconsin, and the weather just affected us so much. I just everything we did, you know, I still remember how we'd have nice hay cut in the field and all of a sudden a surprise thunderstorm would come in and wash it away, you know, and it would ruin... And we were not rich. We had a family of 8 children, and I was the youngest, and our parents put us all through college on that. I don't know how, but they did. But, you know, just the struggles that the weather gave us and the joys, too, because sometimes it helped us produce some really nice crops for our cows and had a great year. But I always wondered what was causing these things, the thunderstorms and the lightning and the snowstorms in the winter that would blow and drift and block our roads shut. And so I attribute it to that. I think it just I was out in the weather so much as a kid.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That makes a lot of sense. Thanks so much for that question. I think we've got Mike and, well, let's see, we've got an email. Let me take that. Mike and Nina wonders, what do you mean when you say a 20% chance of rain or snow?
Well, there's a couple of different ways to look at it. Generally, the lower the number, of course, the lower the chance is going to be. I was taught way back when I started, basically a 20%, it's the coverage of the shower activity or snow, whatever it happens to be. So basically 100% chance that a shower will occur or rain will occur, but only covering 20% of the area. So in your viewing area, if you say there's a 20% chance of showers, you'd expect about one out of every 5 places to be hit by some rain or snow. There's other ways to look at it too. You know, it's just, it's kind of a complicated thing, but in general, small chances, less chance of precipitation, high chances, high confidence. It's just kind of don't look too much into it if you're just a viewer. But know that, you know, if there's a 30% chance of rain, that doesn't mean it can't rain at your house, okay? It means that there's a chance, but we do expect it to be scattered in nature.
All right. Let's take a question now from Mike in Wausau. Mike, hi.
Yeah, I was wondering, Tony, can you talk about the effect of large metropolitan areas like the Twin Cities has on your forecasts?
being that they're such a heat sink?
That's right. Well, I do have customers in the Twin Cities, quite a few of them actually. And they're part of a large urban heat island, of course. You know, that metropolitan area stretches about 60 miles in any one direction. Just a lot of concrete, a lot of buildings absorbing heat and putting out heat. And so they're often, at night especially, 5 to 8 degrees warmer than the surrounding areas. You can even notice that in Stevens Point or Wausau area. The airport in Wausau, which is downtown, often runs 8 or 10 degrees warmer than at night on a clear night than the surrounding countryside. So we always have to take that into consideration for temperature forecasting. Also for the formation of ice and snow in the winter on roadways in particular. You know, it's often just wet in the city, in the inner part of the cities, but it might be slippery or slushy, snow covered on the outskirts. So those are definitely some real concerns. And there's some wind issues that go on with the terrain of a city and so on versus the country and other things as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, Jill is looking at me and saying, hey, I've got somebody here who wants to ask a question that they want to ask. And so I will get back to snafus in just a minute. Let's go there.
Hi. I am old, and so when I was growing up, there were like three basic kinds of clouds. And I was taught that if you see the cirrus clouds, it's going to rain within a day. Is that true?
Well, it's not 100% correlation, but it is generally kind of a good rule of thumb. You know, generally as a storm system gathers off to the west a few states, you'll start to see high, thin cirrus clouds come in. You might see a ring around the moon at night or a halo around the sun. And then as the system gets closer, the clouds will lower and eventually become stratus or nimbostratus or some variation thereof. As the moisture gets deeper and produce precipitation. But it doesn't always happen that way. Sometimes we just have cirrus clouds drifting through without any precipitation associated with them. So you have to be a little bit careful with some of those general rules.
Val in Green Bay has a question for you. Let's go there.
Hi, I'm also on the older side, and I have a question that I remember it not ever being this hot and humid when I was a kid. And I'm wondering if the excessive humidity that we're having like today, do you think it's related to something called the corn sweat, which means now as the corn crop comes on and we're cultivating so much more in the field that it's contributing massive amounts of humidity over the Midwest, and it's just building up humidity like we've never had before. Is that a thing?
Well, we've always had corn sweat. That is a real thing, by the way. You know, corn emits a huge amount of moisture as it's growing, mm-hmm. especially when it's about in its mid-cycle, maybe more like in July, early August, which can raise the dew point by maybe as much as 3 to 5 degrees in a particular area. This has been well studied in Iowa, especially.
Very much
yes.
in Iowa.
So that's nothing new. I mean, yeah, we do grow a little more corn, I believe, than we used to, so that might be a small indicator, but more importantly, with a warmer ocean atmosphere system that we have, it is holding more water vapor. So, you know, it's estimated already that we're, I believe, holding about 7% more water vapor than we were just, you know, like 60 to 80 years ago. So that's got to go somewhere. And if we happen to have the right wind flow to push it here and hold it here for a while, working with those other things, it can feel excessively muggy. And that's one of the reasons we're getting some of these extreme precipitation events where, like, you get 6 inches of rain in one storm. And that's happened for many hundreds of years, of course, but it's happening with more frequency now. And part of that is because we just have more water in the air.
Mm. Take a question from the audience.
Tony, can you explain the correlation between humidity and dew point and which one makes you feel most uncomfortable?
Well, you know, dew point is a better absolute measure. You know, a dew point of, say, 65 degrees Fahrenheit will always feel muggy, whereas a relative humidity could be 90%, and it may not feel muggy at all, depending on the temperature. Basically, dew point is the measure of when moisture will start to condense out and form dew. So at night, as the temperature is dropping, it might be 70, and then get down to 60, you might start getting wet grass or dew on your windshield. That's about the dew point. So the higher the dew point, the more moisture the air is holding. When the dew point and the air temperature are the same thing, then the relative humidity is 100%. But as I say, if the dew point's only 40 and the temperature is 40, it's going to feel a little moist outside, but maybe not uncomfortable muggy. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So the dew point is a very important measure for us.
Yeah, excellent. Another question from the audience.
Hi. I'm wondering why sports broadcasters at the end of their broadcast at either 5 or 6 o'clock will say severe weather ahead, tune in at 10. And you would think that they would give a little bit more information at 5 and 6 when most of us are awake rather than at 10 when we've already slept for two hours.
Oh, those teases.
Yes. Well, I'm not sure why the sports people would be doing that, but I think the weather people are doing that just to get people hooked so they watch at 10 o'clock for an update. Hopefully they've watched already for the main part of the show at 5 or 6, but you can get more information at 10. You know, that's a whole part of TV. There's a whole marketing part, and that's above my pay grade, but, you know.
Kathy in Viroqua, we'll go to you. Hi, Kathy.
Hi. My question is, I'm wondering if you know how effective current firefighting methods have been this year on the ground and from the air, and if any new methods are being developed or even possible.
That's a really good question. I'll be honest, I'm not really a firefighting expert, so I won't be able to answer that super well. Larry, do you know anything about that?
I don't, but that's actually, that's something that might be a show, Jill.
I'm sure like any other field, there's advancements being made all the time in research, but I'm just not aware of what they exactly are. So.
But, you know, it intrigues me, so maybe we can work a half-hour segment into one of our shows. That might be a nice thing to do when we have another Weather Guys show. So stay tuned for that, for sure. And Tony, this has been just great. I'm so happy to have you here.
Well, thank you. It's really been a pleasure to be here and meet some people and talk about the weather. Again, my lifelong passion, and hopefully can do it a long time yet. So.
I hope so, too. Tony Schumacher, owner and chief meteorologist of the Great Lakes Weather Service, started his career back long time back in 1993, and he's still working, and he's got a really good thing going with the Great Lakes Weather Service, a great bunch of professionals to work with clients all over the place, giving specific weather information for those clients. Takes a lot of people to bring you this broadcast live from Plover. I want to thank our friends, certainly from the Farm and Food Exploration Center. explorefoodandfarm.org. explorefoodandfarm.org. Go there for more information. And of course, I want to thank WPR's Wausau Regional Manager, Katie Land, who's done a great job. The Senior Regional Manager, Lisa Nelbandian, our technical directors, Tom Blaine, Tyler Ditter, and Jeff Robbins, and in Madison, Lee Rayburn. Joel Patnod, our producer today and our executive producer with that microphone running around, Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller, and thanks to you, our audience. It's been great fun, and stay with us. Lots in store on WPR News.